Forrestal complained that Jews exercised an undue influence over American policy. When Israel declared its independence on May 14, 1948, Truman quickly accorded her diplomatic recognition over the protests of the State Department and the Pentagon. Israel's formation proved a watershed event for American goals, such as they were, in the Middle East, and it tied the two countries together for the remainder of the 20th century. It permanently placed the United States in the unenviable position of having to referee two implacable foes. It also meant that no matter how much the United States wanted to support various friendly Arab governments, in the end, Israel remained the only true democracy in the region through the 20th and early 21st centuries. American support of Israel inevitably ensured the animosity of the heavily propagandized Arab Street. As soon as the UN partition scheme was pushed through, war broke out, mainly led by Egypt, but with elements of the Syrian, Jordanian, Iraqi, Lebanese, and Palestinian armies outnumbering the 20,000-man Israeli defense forces. Against all expectations, it was the Arab forces that suffered a humiliating defeat, and Israel secured her existence for a time. Although the United States had done little aside from recognizing the State of Israel, suddenly Truman, and soon his successors, had to balance support for Israel against the abundant Arab oil supplies discovered in the region and put into production by the Arab American Oil Company, Aramco. The United States had followed Britain into the Middle Eastern oil fields in 1924, with the American share of oil pumped from the desert growing steadily from one-sixth of the total in 1936 to more than half by the end of World War II. Most of the crude came from Saudi Arabia, but there was oil everywhere, leading the head of the U.S. Petroleum Commission to refer to the Middle East as the center of gravity of world oil production. America's dependence on foreign oil, or better phrased, Detroit's dependence, became more acute during the next round of Arab-Jewish conflicts in 1956 with the Suez Crisis. As with the two wars that followed it, this struggle only marked a continuation of the unresolved hostilities lingering from the 1947-48 Arab-Israeli War. In May 1967, Egypt and her Arab allies were ready to try again to evict Israel. After ejecting the UN peacekeepers, Egyptian President Abdel Gamal Nasser stated on Cairo radio that the offensive was to be a mortal blow of annihilation, and it was his intention to wipe Israel off the map. Again, Israel did not wait to be overwhelmed by the forces concentrating on her borders, but, as in 1956, launched airstrikes that decimated Arab air power, thus exposing invading tank columns to merciless bombardment from the skies. The war lasted only 6 days, allowing Israel to capture the Golan Heights near Galilee, the Sinai, and the West Bank, filling out the biblical boundaries promised the Jews. Yet even after smashing Arab military forces and unifying Jerusalem under Jewish control for the first time since AD 70, the Israeli victory did not produce a lasting peace. Nasser's successor, Anwar Sadat, quickly rebuilt the Egyptian military and organized yet another invasion in 1973. Striking on Yom Kippur, the holiest of Jewish religious observance days, Sadat's well-coordinated attack this time attained success. Supplied by the Soviets, the Arab armies offset the Israeli advantages in the skies, knocking out 20% of Israel's planes in 4 days. Tel Aviv was in panic. Israeli and American citizen Prime Minister Golda Meir persuaded Nixon to provide an emergency airlift of arms, which provided the logistics for a Jewish counterattack after days of absorbing blows. America's airlift was reminiscent of the Berlin effort, covering 6,400 miles per day and delivering thousands of tons of supplies. In his darkest hour, Nixon alone virtually saved Israel. Within a short period, the Israeli counterattack routed the Arab armies. The Soviets, responding to Sadat's request for aid, threatened to enter the conflict. By that time, Nixon was spending virtually all his time combating the Watergate investigators and editing tapes. He deployed Kissinger to respond to the Soviet threat, and in an unprecedented occurrence, Kissinger, not Nixon, issued the orders for American military units to go on full-scale worldwide alert, the first time since JFK had issued similar orders in 1962. Watergate had by then engulfed and distracted the president to the point where he could not conduct international negotiations. The combatants brokered another truce, but this time the United States paid a heavy price for its involvement. In October 1973, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, which represented virtually all of the Muslim oil-producing nations, cut production of oil and boosted prices 70%. 2 months later, OPEC jacked up prices another 128%. Gasoline and home heating oil prices in the United States soared, to which Nixon, the born-again Keynesian, responded by imposing a price ceiling on oil. This made gasoline artificially cheap. Americans knew what gas was really worth, but the government had just encouraged them to act as though it cost a fraction of what it really did. Demand shot up. Supply remained low, but prices were fixed. Available stores of oil disappeared as fast as people could pump the cheap gas into their cars. An incredible spectacle ensued of car lines at gas stations, sometimes reaching completely around city blocks to purchase the scarce yet still cheap fuel. State governments instituted an array of gimmicks to limit consumption, including setting up an even-odd license plate number purchase system. None of it worked. The wealthiest nation in the world slowed to a crawl because the government had artificially lowered fuel prices. The high cost of energy, in turn, sent price shocks throughout industry and commerce. Sugar, which cost 13 cents in 1970, had risen to 33 cents by 1974. Flour, at 11 cents per pound in 1970, had nearly doubled to 20 cents 4 years later. Steaks that had cost $1.54 per pound rose to $2.12 per pound in 1974. Stereos, priced at $119 in 1970, rose to more than $154 in 1974, and a man's shirt rose more than 30% in price. All consumers, not just drivers, were hurt by the government's flawed policies. That did not stop Congress from getting into the act and setting the speed limit on federal highways at 55 miles per hour, a pace that was unrealistic for the vastness of places like Texas or Nevada, and one that often caused auto engines to operate at less than peak efficiency, thus burning more gas. At the same time, Congress also established fuel efficiency standards for all new cars, known as the CAFE regulations, which conflicted directly with the environmental pollution restrictions that lawmakers had earlier placed on automakers. Auto manufacturers responded by adopting lighter materials, such as aluminum and fiberglass, which proved less safe in the event of accidents. Gas mileage went up, but so did highway fatalities, even at slower speeds. The blizzard of rules and regulations only displayed the utter incapability of the government to manage market-related issues. For example, to make cars safer, in 1966, the government implemented the National Traffic Motor Vehicle Safety Act, partly in response to Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed, requiring automakers to install as standard equipment seat belts, impact-absorbing steering columns, and padded dashboards. These additions all drove up weight, which reduced gas mileage. Rather than trust consumers at the showroom to determine which values or characteristics were most important to them, good fuel economy, safety, or environment-friendly features, the government had created battling bureaus, each with its own budget justifications, lobbying against each other for funding. Following individual state mandates, in 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency decreed that auto companies had to reduce emissions to 10% of existing levels by 1976. Language contained in this bill, however, only affected autos made after 1970, by which time emissions in new cars had already been reduced from 70 to 80%. Thus, the new law required the existing autos to further reduce emissions on the remaining 20 to 30% by 90% to a total emissions percentage of 3%. Achieving the last few percent of performance of anything is nearly impossible, and the man who coined the term smog referred to the EPA air quality standards as absurd. Detroit had no choice but to comply. GM introduced the catalytic converter, which only worked with unleaded gasoline. The tetraethyl lead had been removed. This, in turn, entailed a sizable drop-off in power, but made for longer-lasting engines. To compensate for the power drop-off, automakers looked to professional racing for ideas, souping up engines with overhead camshafts, turbochargers, fuel injection, and a host of other high-performance equipment that soon became standard on passenger cars. But the entire process of regulating, then powering up, was the equivalent of adding a small anchor to a boat, then installing the extra engines to overcome the drag. More important, the auto debate in reality remained a growing divide about the sustainability of the internal combustion engine and the availability of oil. Each time the world had started to reach peak oil production, more reserves were found, baffling the environmentalists. This, of course, was human nature. One doesn't make a concerted effort to find additional food until the current supplies are low. Since 2004, when this book was first published, vast new oil and gas fields, over 200 in the year 2009 alone, have been discovered. In 2009, British Petroleum, BP, found a giant deepwater field that might turn out to be the biggest oil discovery ever in the Gulf of Mexico. While most oil experts embraced the peak oil theory that the world was at or close to its peak production capacity for oil and that oil production was doomed to fail, BP's chief economist noted it had wrongly predicted oil production for 150 years. By the early 21st century, most abandoned peak oil notions in light of continual new discoveries and new technologies to extract yet other new deposits, such as shale oil. Fuel efficiency, of course, is desirable if the market determines that it is a more important use of scarce resources than, say, cost or safety. When the United States had limitless forests, colonists burned trees at record levels because they were cheap. Whale oil was only replaced as interior illumination when it got more expensive than John D. Rockefeller's kerosene. Thus, when it came to the oil crisis, without the government interference, one fact is undeniable. In 1973 and 1974, American gasoline prices would have risen dramatically, and that, in turn, would have forced down auto use and/or caused consumers themselves to demand more fuel-efficient cars. Based on the evidence of history, these changes would have occurred sooner without Nixon's actions. Honey, I Shrank the Economy. Even though prices were controlled at the pump, Americans felt the oil price hikes ripple through the entire economy via the industrial sector, which had no government protection. This drove up the cost of production, forcing layoffs, pushing the United States into a steep recession. Unemployment rose to 8.5% in 1975, a post-war high, and the gross domestic product, GDP, fell in both 1974 and 1975. The oil-related recession cost the United States as much as 5% of its pre-hike gross national product, GNP, or a level 5 times greater than the cumulative impact of the Navigation Acts that had started the American Revolution. Great society spending and layers of federal regulations made matters worse. Some states and cities suffered even more than the nation as a whole. New York's liberal spending policies swung the city into bankruptcy, and the mayor asked for a federal bailout. New Yorkers had voted themselves into their problems, then looked to taxpayers from Colorado and Rhode Island to dig them out. President Ford, however, courageously promised to veto any federal bailout of the Big Apple. A local newspaper with typical New York attitude ran the headline, "Ford to New York, Drop Dead." In fact, Ford's decision not to reward the city for financial malfeasance was exactly the appropriate constitutional response. Left to their own devices, New Yorkers worked their city back into the black. In almost every area of American life, the federal government had already done quite enough. Whether through the EPA, OSHA, the Consumer Products Safety Commission, or myriad other new agencies, government at all levels had started to heap voluminous oppressive regulations on business. In 1975 alone, 177 proposed new rules appeared, as did 2,865 proposed amendments, for a total of 10,656 new and proposed rules and amendments, most of which applied to nearly all firms. According to one study, environmental regulations enacted prior to 1990 by themselves, not including the 1970 Clean Air Act, the single largest anti-pollution law, reduced the GNP by 2.5%. Activists such as Ralph Nader and the environmentalists expected the evil corporations to simply absorb the costs, never expressing concern about the average people who had invested in such businesses to provide funds for a new home or a college education for the children. Companies, of course, did not just passively accept the new costly regulations. Instead, American business battled the government on three fronts: increasing spending for lobbyists in Congress, fighting the new rules in the judicial system and in the court of public opinion, and passing along the costs of the regulations to the consumers. Not surprisingly, the pages in the Federal Register, which contained these rules, ballooned from 10,286 in 1950 to 61,000 in 1978. And at the same time, the number of attorneys in the United States rose by 52% in a 10-year period. More important, district court cases grew 131%, and U.S. appeals court civil cases, where product liability cases more likely occurred, exploded by 398%. Predictably, corporations spent more on their legal divisions, while spending on research and development, the lifeblood of new products, consistently fell. There simply was not enough money to fund both lawyers and scientists. Every dollar spent to influence a lawmaker or run consumer-friendly ads was a dollar not spent on developing better and safer products or reducing the costs of existing goods. By 1980, America had 4 times as many attorneys per capita as Germany and 20 times more per capita than Japan, both of which had surged ahead of the United States in productivity, the key indicator of real economic growth. Meanwhile, big business was working against itself by avoiding change and innovation the way dogs resist baths. Significantly, not one of the top 50 technological changes in 20th century America came from established leaders in the field. IBM did not create the personal computer, nor did the calculator giant of IBM's day, the slide rule company Coiful, create the punch card computer. Airplanes sprang from the minds of bicycle mechanics and word processing programs from the scribblings of college dropouts. Cellular phones were not developed by AT&T or even the famous Bell Labs. Stability had served industry well when the United States passed some of the other fading economic powers, then easily perpetuated growth during the post-war decade when there was little competition. But then complacency set in. Once the Japanese and Germans re-entered world markets, U.S. companies lacked the competitive edge that had served them well half a century earlier. Afraid of rapid change, corporations introduced only marginal improvements. Automakers for almost two decades thought that merely by tweaking a body style or introducing minor interior comforts, they could compete with dramatic changes in actual auto design from Japan. Japanese car makers had struggled for 10 years to adapt their vehicles to American roads and to larger American physiques. So when oil prices suddenly placed greater value on smaller front-wheel drive, fuel-efficient cars, Honda, Nissan, and Toyota were more than ready. To their discredit, American auto executives continued to denigrate foreign innovations. It took a bankrupt Chrysler Corporation under Lee Iacocca, the brains behind the Ford Mustang, to shock Detroit out of its doldrums. "We were wrong," he announced in one of Chrysler's television ads. New industrial evangelists like Iacocca, even had they been in the majority, constituted only half the equation for turning American business around. Labor, led by the hardscrabble union bosses who had achieved great gains at tremendous cost in the 1950s and 1960s, still acted as though it spoke for a majority of working Americans. By the 1970s, however, the unions were losing members at precipitous rates. Trade unions had formed a critical part of the Democratic Party's New Deal coalition, and the most important organizations, the AFL-CIO and the Teamsters, were able to demand exceptionally high wages for their members in the automobile, steel, and trucking industries. By 1970, a typical line worker in Detroit commanded $22 an hour in 1990s dollars, owned two cars, a boat, and a vacation home on a lake, or the equivalent of the earnings of a mid-level attorney in 2002. Miners and truckers, as well as those working in manufacturing jobs, had substantially higher incomes than many professionals and received better benefits than people in almost any income category. Unionized employees routinely made between $10,000 and $12,000 per year with overtime. New homes sold for about $23,000, meaning that a worker dedicating 30% of his income to a mortgage could own a house in 6 or 7 years, which compared quite closely to a current-day professional earning a $100,000 salary and supporting a $250,000 mortgage. More significant for the long-term survival of American industry, the unions had demanded, and weak CEOs had agreed to, lavish medical and retirement plans. By the first decade of the 21st century, General Motors would pay more for the medical coverage of its employees than it did for all the raw materials it needed to make cars. Such benefits were utterly unsustainable. Higher prices in steel and autos were passed on to consumers, which added to inflation. American manufactured products, especially textiles, steel, autos, and electronics, rose in price relative to foreign competition. In steel alone, the cost of labor was 6 times that of foreign competitors. Sometime in the early 1970s, prices exceeded the threshold that most consumers were willing to pay in order to remain loyal to American-made products, and buyers began to switch to foreign goods. Recapturing formerly loyal customers is twice as difficult as holding them. Japanese and European manufacturers who were turning out lower-priced quality goods gained millions of new American customers in the 1970s. For the first time, made in Japan was not viewed as a sign of cheap, shoddy goods, but as a mark of quality. Foreign competitors increased their steel production by some 700 million net tons, and builders scrambled to replace expensive American steel with fiberglass, aluminum, plastics, ceramics, and concrete. American steel companies took the biggest hit of all. The industry had seen its international market share fall 20% since the Korean War, when U.S. steelmakers claimed 60% of the world's sales. Worse, only one new steel plant, a Bethlehem facility in Indiana, was constructed between 1950 and 1970. At the same time, Japan gave birth to 53 new integrated steel companies, most of them with brand new efficient mills, and Japanese assets in steel plants rose 23% between 1966 and 1972, compared to an investment in American plants of only 4%. The overall output of U.S.-made steel barely changed between 1948 and 1982, leading many steel executives to try to diversify their companies. Layoffs began with the expectation that they would be temporary. Then weeks stretched into months and into years. By 1980, it was clear that after years of sounding unheeded warnings, the wolf had finally come, and the industry would never return to its 1960s peak. This was the last gasp of organized union power in manufacturing America. From 35% of the American workforce in 1960, union membership entered a downward spiral to 27% of the workforce in 1990. That did not tell the whole story, however, because the hardcore industrial unions had plunged even more sharply than the total, which was kept afloat only by the two largest unions in America, the National Education Association, NEA, and the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME. By 1980, AFSCME had twice the membership of the United Steelworkers. Thus, it became eminently clear why organized labor had a commitment to a permanently large and growing government and to public schools. Those employees, operating monopolies outside the free market, now represented unions' only hope of long-term survival. The ensuing recession shattered the underlying premises of Keynesian economics once and for all. According to the prevailing Phillips curve theory, an economy could not have both high unemployment and high inflation at the same time. This stemmed from the notion that inflation resulted from government spending for new jobs. It was all poppycock. The government could not create wealth in the 1970s any more than it could in the 1930s. More accurately, a bizarre expectations game occurred, taxflation, wherein businesses sensed that when new government programs were announced, their taxes would go up, and they responded by hiking prices merely in anticipation of the new taxes. Gerald Ford possessed none of the qualities needed to deal with any aspect of the sinking economy. As a progressive, so-called moderate Republican, he sympathized with much of the Great Society spending. As a caretaker president, he did not possess the public support to force OPEC to increase production or lower prices. And as a Nixon appointee, he faced a hostile and rogue Congress out to destroy all vestiges of the modern Republican Party, much the way the radical Republicans in Reconstruction had hoped to kill the Democratic Party. All Ford had in his favor was honesty, but his lack of imagination left him helpless in the face of further business declines. Having no desire for tax cuts that might revive the economy and blocked by a spendthrift Congress that would not enact tax cuts anyway, Ford launched a campaign that was almost comedic in design. He sought to mobilize public support to hold down prices by introducing WIN, Whip Inflation Now, buttons. The damage done to the American economy by almost a decade of exorbitant social spending, increasing environmental and workplace regulations, and Keynesian policies from the Johnson-Nixon administrations cannot be overstated. Yet just as government almost never gets the credit when economic growth occurs, so too its overall impact on the nation's business health must be tempered with the appreciation for the poor planning and lack of innovation in the corporate sector. All that, combined with the impact of greedy union demands in heavy industry, made any foolish policies of government relatively insignificant. Perhaps worst of all, inflation had eroded earnings, creating new financial pressures for women to work. Sex, the Church, and the Collapse of Marriage. By the mid-1970s, women's entry into the workforce was being championed by the 20th century feminist movement. Armed with the pill, feminists targeted the seeming lack of fairness in the job market, which punished women for dropping out of the market for several years to have children. But where their rhetoric failed to change corporations, the pill changed women. By delaying childbirth, the pill allowed women to enter professional schools in rapidly growing numbers. Paradoxically, the pill placed more pressure on women to protect themselves during sex. And rather than liberating women for a career in place of a family, feminism heaped a career on top of a family. Women's workloads only grew, and the moral burden on women to resist the advances of males expanded geometrically. Equally ironic, as women entered the workforce in greater numbers, increasing the expectation that young married women would work, the expectations index for couples soared. Newlyweds saw larger houses with bigger mortgages and more upscale cars as the norm because, after all, they had two incomes. This created a feedback loop that forced women to remain in the labor force after childbearing, and in many cases after they wished to leave their jobs outside the home. With all biological consequences removed from engaging in pre- or extramarital sex, the only barrier remaining was religion. But the church had seen much of its moral authority shattered in the 1960s, when on the one hand, large numbers of white Christians had remained mute during the civil rights struggles, and on the other, liberal leftist elements in the church had associated themselves with communist dictators. In either case, the church, as many saw it, had allied itself with oppression against liberty. When it came to sex, traditional Christianity had appeared hypocritical. Wives who dutifully served their families had to deal with alcoholic husbands and domestic abuse. It is crucial to understand that perception is reality, and while the vast majority of husbands loved and served their wives, the fact that any domestic abuse occurred without comment from the local pulpit or a visit from the pastor or priest was unacceptable. The more traditional and fundamentalist churches that preached against divorce and railed against premarital sex said little to nothing about spouse or child abuse in their own congregations. At the other extreme, churches attempting to reach out to women and portray themselves as modern opened their pulpits to female ministers, but ignored the moral necessity of demanding chastity and commitment from Christians in sexual matters. The former group preached piety and practiced unacceptable toleration of sin, while the latter celebrated its toleration but ignored holiness. For all their failures to stand up for women's and civil rights, the hardline fundamentalist churches nevertheless continued to grow throughout the 1960s and early 1970s, if for no other reason than it was clear they stood for clear and unwavering principles. Liberal Protestant denominations, on the other hand, shrank at shocking rates, despite their new inclusion policies. American Baptists, Disciples of Christ, Episcopalians, Lutherans, Methodists, Presbyterians, and United Church of Christ all lost members from 1960 to 1975. Although people claimed that they stayed home on Sunday because they thought churches were behind the times, those churches most behind the times seemed to thrive. Southern Baptists nearly doubled in numbers of churches between 1958 and 1971. Even more astounding, televangelist Oral Roberts, a charismatic faith healer, reached 2.3 million viewers in a single broadcast, a number that nearly equaled the entire estimated Sunday attendance of all the Methodist churches in the nation. When one combined the audiences of the top eight televised ministries during a single broadcast, virtually all of them outside the mainstream, they matched that of the estimated church attendance of the top six denominations combined. Indeed, one scholar looking at these viewing trends concluded that the numbers reveal a previously unmapped dimension of religion in America, a basic fundamentalist orientation that cuts across denominational lines. Transcending denominational differences went so far as to see Protestants and Catholics beginning to share similar worship experiences. The Roman Catholic Church had modernized with its Vatican II, 1962-65, council, making such changes as having the priest face the congregation for Mass, which now was said in English, not Latin. Nevertheless, the Catholic Church at mid-century witnessed a stunning decline not only in members, but in clergy. American nuns decreased in number by 14,000 in the last half of the 60s, and by 1976, 45,000 priests and nuns had abandoned the cloth. Among the vanguard order, the Jesuits, recruitment numbers plummeted by 80% in the 1990s. Although American Catholicism revived in the latter part of the 20th century because of immigration, it still had difficulty attracting young men to its seminaries and women to its convents. A subculture of homosexuality began to permeate the orders, driving out heterosexual men who vowed to remain celibate, creating what was called the gaying and graying of the church. In 2002, this exploded as a full-scale scandal when several lawsuits were brought against many priests for sexual abuse and pedophilia, threatening to bankrupt the Boston Catholic Church. But the church claimed to be unaware of these offenses. One subgroup within the Catholic Church, however, the Catholic Charismatic Movement, nevertheless showed strong gains. It did so because it intersected with the Protestant faith movement with spiritual expressions such as speaking in tongues, healing, and other supernatural outpourings. Clearly, a major split had occurred in the American church from 1960 to 1975, and it did so rather rapidly. In 1962, for example, some 31% of those polled said that religion was losing its influence, almost twice as many as had answered the question affirmatively 5 years earlier. At nearly the same time, the Federal Communications Commission had begun allowing television and radio stations to use paid programming to fulfill their public service broadcasting requirements. This silenced the mainstream liberal churches, which suddenly found that despite a decade's worth of monopoly over the airwaves, they could no longer generate enough funds to purchase airtime. Instead, the so-called fundamentalist and Pentecostal denominations dominated the airwaves, having honed their skills at the fringes of the industry. Indeed, Pentecostal denominations and even non-denominational congregations led by individual charismatic, in all senses of the word, leaders, soared in membership. Oral Roberts, the best-known of the faith ministers, built an entire university and hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and some of his students, such as Kenneth Copeland or contemporaries such as Kenneth Hagin, developed powerful healing and prosperity ministries. Traditional churches, of course, despised the charismatics, whose main identifying practice was that of speaking in tongues under the influence of the Holy Spirit. These charismatic churches featured several characteristics that antagonized the mainstream churches. They were racially integrated, they crossed all economic lines, and women had prominent positions of power in the organizations. Faith healer Catherine Kuhlman, for example, had been the first female with a regular religious show on television. Discrimination still existed, and many of the Pentecostal denominations still frowned on interracial marriage, but compared to the mainstream church, the underground Pentecostal movement was remarkably free of racism, classism, and gender bias. Instead of moving in the direction of their flocks, mainstream churches sought to be inclusive, leading them to reinterpret church practices in a number of areas. Most of the mainstream churches, for example, started to ordain women by the 1970s. These female ministers in liberal Protestant churches tended to side with radical feminists on the most volatile issues of the day, especially abortion. Scarcely had the ink dried on the key sexual reproduction case of the century, Roe v. Wade, 1973, than the Methodists, Presbyterians, American Baptists, United Church of Christ, Disciples of Christ, and Episcopal Church all adopted pro-abortion positions. In 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court, hearing a pair of cases, generally referred to by the first case's name, Roe v. Wade, concluded that Texas anti-abortion laws violated a constitutional right to privacy. Of course, no such phrase can be found in the Constitution. That, however, did not stop the court from establishing, with no law ever being passed and no constitutional amendment ever being ratified, the premise that a woman had a constitutional right to an abortion during the first trimester of pregnancy. Later, sympathetic doctors would expand the context of health risk to the mother so broadly as to permit abortions almost on demand. Instantly, the feminist movement leaped into action, portraying unborn babies as first fetuses, then as blobs of tissue. A battle with pro-life forces led to an odd media acceptance of each side's own terminology of itself. The labels that the media used were pro-choice, not pro-abortion, and pro-life, not anti-choice. What was not so odd was the stunning explosion of abortions in the United States, which totaled at least 35 million over the first 25 years after Roe. Claims that without safe and legal abortions, women would die in abortion mills seemed to pale beside the stack of fetal bodies that resulted from the change in abortion laws. For those who had championed the pill as liberating women from the natural results of sex, babies, this proved nettlesome. More than 82% of the women who chose abortion in 1990 were unmarried. Had not the pill protected them? Had it not liberated them to have sex without consequences? The bitter fact was that with the restraints of the church removed, the pill and feminism had only exposed women to higher risks of pregnancy and thus eligibility for an abortion. It also exempted men almost totally from their role as fathers, leaving them the easy escape of pointing out to the female that abortion was an alternative to having an illegitimate child. Fatherhood and the role of men was already under assault by feminist groups. By the 1970s, fathers had become a central target for the media, especially entertainment. Fathers were increasingly portrayed as buffoons, even as evil, on primetime television. Comedies, according to one study of 30 years of network television, presented blue-collar or middle-class fathers as foolish, although less so than the portrayals of upper-class fathers. Feminists had unwittingly given men a remarkable gift, pushing as they had for no-fault divorce. Divorce laws began changing at the state level in the early 1970s, at which time a full court hearing and proof of cause was no longer required. Instead, if both parties agreed that they had irreconcilable differences, they simply obtained an inexpensive, no-fault divorce. This proved a boon for men because it turned the social world into an arena of sexual competition, making men and women view each other as prey and their own sex as competitors to a degree that corrodes civility. Divorce rates skyrocketed, with more than 1.1 million divorces occurring in 1979, and the number of children under the age of 18 who lived in one-parent families rising during the decade of the 1970s from 11% to 19%. Although it took about 20 years for sociologists to study the phenomena, scholars almost universally agree by the 1990s that children of one-parent families suffered from more pathologies, more criminal behaviors, worse grades, and lower self-esteem than kids from traditional families. A husband, able to easily escape from matrimony because it no longer proved fulfilling, or more likely he desired a younger woman, now only had to show that he could not get along with his current wife, not that she had done anything wrong or been unfaithful. In turn, the process called the one-to-a-customer rule by George Gilder in his controversial Men and Marriage was instantly killed. In its place, wealthy older men could almost always attract younger women, but older women, regardless of their personal wealth, usually could not attract men their age, who instead snapped up younger hard bodies, as these physically fit women were called. Whereas in previous eras, these younger women would have married middle or lower class men of roughly their own age and started families, they now became prey for the middle-aged wealthy men with Jennifer fever. The new Jennifer herself only lasted temporarily until she, too, was discarded. Pools of available middle-aged women, often with money, and younger men may have seemed to sociologists to be a logical match, but in fact the two groups were biologically and culturally incompatible. Instead, young men with looks and vitality battled against older males with money and status for the affections of an increasingly smaller group of 20 to 30-year-old females, while an army of middle-aged female divorcees struggled to raise children from one or more marriages. Feminism's sexual freedom thus placed older women into a no-win competition with the young, and in either group, the losers of the game had limited options. The process slowly created an entirely new class of females who lacked male financial support and who had to turn to the state as a surrogate husband, producing one of the most misunderstood political phenomena of the late 20th century, the so-called gender gap. In reality, as most political analysts admit, this was a marriage gap. Married women voted Republican in about the same number as men did. It was only the single mothers, as casualties of the sexual free-fire zone the feminists had dropped them into, who saw government as a savior instead of a threat. Meanwhile, thanks to the women's movement, a new option opened to women in the 1970s that had not existed to the same degree in earlier decades: a career. Women applied to law and medical schools, moved into the universities, and even gradually made inroads into engineering and the hard sciences. Inflation had actually smoothed the way for women to enter professional fields. As families struggled and a second income was needed, men usually preferred their wives to have the highest-paying job possible. Personnel directors and company presidents, usually men, could not help but appreciate the fact that many of their own wives had started to interview for jobs, too. Over time, this realization helped override any macho chauvinism they may have possessed. The working female brought a new set of economic realities. First, large numbers of women entering the workforce tended to distort the statistics. There is no question that more overall activity occurred in the economy, as women now spent more on housekeepers, gas, fast food, and childcare. But there were also hidden economic indicators of social pathology. Suicides were up, as was drug use, alcoholism, clinical depression, and, of course, divorce. What went almost unnoticed was that productivity, the key measure of all wealth growth, fell steadily throughout the 1970s, despite a tidal wave of women entering the job markets. An influx of women into the labor pool led feminists to cite another right, that of equal pay for equal work, arguing that so-called women's jobs paid less than men's positions, even though they were not the same work with the same skill sets or risk exposure. Feminists revived the dormant Equal Rights Amendment, which was passed out of Congress in 1972 and ratified by 30 of the 38 necessary states. Just when ratification seemed a sure thing, a housewife and Goldwater-era activist from Illinois, Phyllis Schlafly, created the Stop ERA movement. She argued it would destroy the family, erode women's rights to alimony, and even make them subject to the draft. Enlisting her own army of volunteers, many of them well-educated women, Schlafly aggressively battled the ERA forces, debating them in public forums and usually winning, often forcing her opponents into attacking her personally. Feminist Betty Friedan called her an Aunt Tom and a traitor to your sex. Despite overwhelming opposition by women's magazines, Hollywood actresses, celebrities, and even President Ford's wife Betty, Schlafly successfully led anti-ERA votes in four state legislatures, dooming the amendment. Nevertheless, many of Schlafly's worst predictions came true, particularly as they applied to feminists' impact on the family. As more women moved into the workforce, there were increased family pressures for child care. Once touted as the salvation of the working family, child care has been shown to be undesirable at best and extremely damaging at worst. Moreover, with both parents coming home around 6 in the evening, families tend to eat out more, send out laundry more often, and pay for yard or other domestic work, as well as additional taxes, all of which chewed up most of the extra cash brought in by the wife's job. Although by 1978 the median family income had risen to $17,640, up from $9,867 in 1970, that increase had occurred by having two adults rather than one in the workplace. Children increasingly were viewed as impediments to a more prosperous lifestyle, and accordingly, the number of live births fell sharply from what it had been in 1960. All of these indicators told Americans what they already had known for years. The golden accident of the 1950s had slowed, if not stopped, altogether. Social upheaval, which was excused in the 1960s as an expression of legitimate grievances, took on a darker tone as illegitimacy yielded gangs of young boys in the inner cities, and in suburban homes, both parents worked 40 hours a week to stay afloat. It would provide the Democratic challenger to the presidency with a powerful issue in November 1976, even if no other reasons to oust Ford existed. But events abroad would prove disastrous for Gerald Ford. Foreign policy adrift. Domestic issues may have absorbed Americans' attention more after Vietnam, but foreign threats had hardly diminished. Making matters worse, Ford was weak in dealing with foreign leaders. Soviet dictators, always probing for soft spots, found one at Vladivostok in 1974 when Ford met with Soviet Premier Leonid Brezhnev. A hardline communist, Brezhnev nevertheless was vulnerable. He had suffered a series of strokes that had left him a semi-invalid, attended constantly by a KGB nurse who fed him a daily stream of pills without consulting his doctors. His entourage was followed everywhere by a resuscitation vehicle. When it came to bargaining with the main adversary, as he viewed the United States, Brezhnev differed little from Stalin. He was searching for a strategic advantage that could offset several new U.S. military technologies. Of most concern to the Soviets was the anti-ballistic missile, ABM, system allowed under SALT I. If deployed across the nation, even at low levels of effectiveness, anti-missile missiles could effectively combat nuclear warheads aimed at the United States. The ABM system represented a tremendous bargaining chip against the Soviets, since their heavy land-based missiles represented their only guaranteed threat against the United States, whereas American deterrent forces were evenly divided within the triad of submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, long-range bombers, and ICBMs. Another concern for the USSR was the new MIRV capability of U.S. missiles. MIRV, or Multiple Independent Reentry Vehicles, meant that a single American ICBM could hit multiple targets. Its bus vehicle, carrying up to 10 MIRVs, could deliver nuclear payloads to as many as 10 different locations within a broad target area. Therefore, any advantage the Soviets had in sheer numbers of missiles was offset by the ability to convert existing U.S. ICBMs to MIRVs. Political will, however, proved more important than advanced technology. As long as Nixon remained in office, he could, with some degree of certainty, keep together a pro-Pentagon coalition of Republicans and hawk Democrats, such as Richard Russell of Georgia and Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington. Ford, in contrast, was out of his element. He and his advisors failed to distinguish between warheads and launchers. The Russians enthusiastically agreed to a new SALT treaty, SALT II, that placed limits on launchers, leaving the United States at a permanent disadvantage, which could only be counterbalanced by introducing newer and more survivable submarines, bombers, and ICBM systems. To obtain a treaty that had so clearly put the United States at a disadvantage, Ford and Congress had assured the Joint Chiefs of Staff, without whose approval the treaty would never have passed, that programs such as the B-1 bomber, MX missile, ABM system, and Trident submarine would continue to be funded. Like the support of Vietnam, all these promises rested solely on the will and character of the President and Congress who stood behind them. I'll never lie to you. Had Gerald Ford not had social decay and economic disruption to deal with, he still would have been hard-pressed to defeat Georgia Governor James Earl Jimmy Carter in 1976. Carter was one of a line of presidential candidates to run against Washington. Born in Plains, Georgia, the first president born in a hospital, Carter was raised in a religious household. He was a professed born-again Christian and a practicing Baptist. He graduated from the United States Naval Academy, entering the submarine service under the father of the nuclear navy, Admiral Hyman Rickover. After his service ended, Carter ran his family's substantial peanut farm and seed enterprise, making him the first president since Truman to have any significant experience in private business. He entered Georgia politics, winning the governorship in 1970, which gave him all the qualifications, except for foreign policy experience, to hold the highest office. He had improved the efficiency of his state government bureaucracy and ran it on budget, a point that allowed him to criticize Washington's deficit spending. A Southerner and a Southern Baptist, Carter appealed to both white conservatives and the religious faithful who perceived that morality was slipping from public service. His military service suggested that he would not abandon the military, and his commitment to racial justice showed that he would not abandon blacks. He impressed many as being extraordinarily bright. Historian Christopher Lash called him the most intelligent politician to have risen to national prominence in a long time, a view echoed by gonzo journalist Hunter Thompson. Carter also benefited from the self-destruction of the last Kennedy rival. Senator Edward Ted Kennedy, the youngest and last of Joe Kennedy's boys, and easily the least talented politically, had cultivated hopes of attaining the presidency that his brother Robert, in the eyes of many, had been denied by an assassin's bullet. Certainly, the Democratic Party would have enthusiastically welcomed a Kennedy heading a ticket. But in July 1969, Kennedy drove his Oldsmobile off a bridge at Chappaquiddick Island, drowning his passenger, staffer Mary Jo Kopechne. The implications of cavorting with his young campaign worker were damaging and probably contributed to Kennedy's decision to leave the scene of the accident. He did not even report the incident to police and made no effort to save the trapped woman as she drowned. The Kennedy spin machine immediately flew into high gear, containing the press coverage, inquest, and grand jury probe. Still, few scholars looking at the evidence have concluded anything other than the fact that Ted Kennedy was culpable in the death of Kopechne. After lying low in 1972, Kennedy took the nation's political pulse in 1976, and found that tremendous resentment accompanied the unanswered questions about the incident. He quietly ceded the field to the Georgia governor. Having begun a long preparation in 1974, Carter sealed the nomination and then led Gerald Ford by some 30 points in the polls. Selecting Walter Mondale of Minnesota as his vice presidential running mate, Carter nailed down his liberal base, then veered back to the center with pithy but pointed remarks. "I'll never lie to you," he told the public, then proved it by giving Playboy magazine an interview, the first presidential candidate to do so, in which he admitted that he had lusted in his heart after women. Such poor judgment undercut his image as a religious man and helped erode much of the lead he had built up. Ford proved little better. Having barely held off challenger Ronald Reagan in the Republican primary, Ford blundered by stating in a television debate that Eastern Europe was not under Soviet domination. Americans concluded that Ford was dense or uninformed. His running mate, moderate Kansas Senator Bob Dole, a disabled war veteran, was designated the attack dog, endowing him with a reputation for conservatism he did not deserve. Ultimately, the campaign turned on the economy rather than either candidate's competence. Carter's aides concocted a misery index comprised of the unemployment rate added to the inflation rate, which, depending on the source, was 10% in 1975, but had dropped back to about 6% at election time. Carter asked a simple question of the voters: are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Most people answered in the negative, giving Carter a 51-48% popular vote margin, but a much narrower electoral victory, 297-240. A swing of two large states, such as Ohio and Pennsylvania, would have made Ford president. Any Democratic strategist looking at the map would have been concerned. Carter had lost the entire West except for Texas, most of New England, and the key Midwestern states of Illinois, Michigan, and Indiana. The party's success came almost entirely from the South, where only Virginia voted for Ford. Attempting to enhance the outsider image, Carter walked rather than rode in his inaugural parade. He sold the White House yacht and adopted an informal atmosphere, even wearing a sweater instead of a suit during a televised fireside chat. Like Ford's win button, though, the cardigan sweater gained a negative connotation, reflecting the president's inability to do anything about the ongoing energy crisis. Invoking a preacher's style of moral calling to the public, Carter encouraged Americans to turn down their thermostats and conserve. Labeling the energy crisis the moral equivalent of war, Carter only stirred up memories of the last two wars the nation had entered and lost, Vietnam and the War on Poverty. Adopting a comprehensive energy policy, Carter and Congress rolled out multi-million-dollar subsidies for solar and wind power, biomass, and other alternative fuels, virtually none of which could come online soon enough to affect the nation's immediate energy problems. Wind farms of massive and unsightly windmills only generated a fraction of the kilowatts of a soundly run coal-fired or hydroelectric plant. Solar power, which worked well in places like Arizona and Florida, was dangerous to install and nearly useless in colder climates. The nation desperately needed new sources of energy, and the cheapest and safest was nuclear power. But already the anti-nuclear movement had demonized atomic energy, even though two of the nations with the longest history of nuclear power use, France and Japan, had not had a serious accident until the Japanese earthquake in 2011 damaged the Fukushima reactor, releasing large amounts of radioactive material. Russia experienced a nuclear meltdown at Chernobyl in 1986 when the closed nature of the communist government under Mikhail Gorbachev hamstrung efforts to rescue those exposed and to bring in aid. Nuclear power in America had already experienced a much lower-level nuclear leak in March 1979, when an accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Pennsylvania necessitated the release of radioactive gases. Not a single person was killed or injured, but the media and activists ensured that nuclear plant construction would be dramatically curtailed if not stopped. Like all sources of energy, nuclear power had its share of risks and disadvantages, but on average it remained a desirable source of power for the remainder of the 20th and early 21st century. Leverage over other foreign powers proved even more difficult for Carter than Ford because the new president imposed a requirement that countries observe basic human rights. Longtime allies in Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East suddenly became the objects of criticism. Although Carter did point out Soviet treatment of dissidents, he avoided any broad and energetic condemnation of either the Soviet or Chinese systems, both of which were inherently hostile to human rights. The entire policy, designed to reverse the Realpolitik of Henry Kissinger, was fraught with danger. No nation, including the United States, with its history of slavery and its treatment of Native Americans and Japanese Americans during World War II, had hands that were entirely clean. On a practical level, spying demanded that one work with people of questionable character, murderers, terrorists, and people willing to sell out their own countrymen. From where else would the information come? And when it came to strategic issues, the time-tested rule was, "My enemy's enemy is my friend." Implementing the most idealistic foreign policy since Woodrow Wilson was Wall Street lawyer Cyrus Vance, Secretary of State, and Columbia University professors Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor, a Polish-born liberal wrongly portrayed as a Cold War hawk. Carter also appointed Andrew Young, a veteran of the civil rights movement with no foreign experience, as the ambassador to the United Nations. Their inexperience compounded the impracticality of human rights emphasis in foreign policy. Carter infuriated conservatives by winning Senate ratification of the treaty returning the Panama Canal Zone to the nation of Panama and announcing support of black majority rule in several African states. He denounced pro-U.S. Latin American dictators, which encouraged the Cuban-backed communist Sandinista guerrillas to overthrow the Somoza government in Nicaragua. In each instance, Carter traded the substance of strategic control and genuine working alliances for a shadowy world of public opinion and goodwill. Carter finally appeared to have found his stride in foreign relations when he played a broker's role in negotiating a remarkable Middle East peace. Faced with prospects of another Arab-Israeli war, Carter invited leaders of Egypt and Israel to the Camp David retreat. Egypt was represented by its president, Anwar el-Sadat, who had allied with the Nazis in World War II. Israel sent its prime minister, Menachem Begin, who was a member of Israeli Irgun commando units. These were fighters, men who knew war and had no illusions about the cost, but who were also fatigued and desperate for a compromise. Meeting in September 1978 with Carter smoothing over hard points and even jawboning the pair to keep them from walking out, Begin and Sadat signed the Camp David Accords in February 1979 in Washington, D.C. This normalized relations between Egypt and Israel and paved the way for Israel to withdraw from the Sinai Peninsula. The final agreement, however, was accomplished only when Carter bribed the signatories with the largest ever American foreign aid package, a total of $5 billion over a 3-year period. Israeli withdrawal, in particular, came when Carter promised that the United States would construct 2 military airfields for Israel in the Negev. Money talked, at least temporarily. Arab states quickly denounced the agreement, and the fundamentalist wing of Islam threatened to boil over. Begin and Sadat won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1978, for which Sadat paid with his life in October 1981 when Islamic extremists in his own army assassinated him. In fact, Egypt obtained everything it wanted, but the Israelis were left to deal with the central canker sore of the region, the Palestinian issue. Israel